Hello, and welcome to another interview from Jason's Connection. I'm Erica McIntyre, Jason's Connection's content director. Today, our founder, Jason Harris, will be speaking with Alice Elliott, an actress, teacher, writer, filmmaker, and media consultant for disability organizations. Alice enjoys creating and distributing films that change the world for people with disabilities. She has made several films, including the Academy Award nominated The Collector of Bedford Street. Her company, Welcome Change Productions, distributes relevant and well-made disability media through their trusted source.
Thank you for joining us today. Can you talk to us about how you got started into acting and what roles you had?
Sure. Actually, I think it had a big influence on my later work, that one of the very first roles I played was Helen Keller in The Miracle Worker. And I worked with my acting coach in high school and really, you know, got very involved in the role and sort of Helen Keller's world. And so I think that had a big influence on the later work that I did. I did take a long time off from working with people with disabilities and I was on a daytime soap opera, daytime television, and I did a number of feature films. But at a certain point, I decided that I wasn't getting roles that really interested me, and so I decided to look at, you know, what stories I really wanted to tell.
Mm-hmm. And what, I think after that you went into screenwriting. I think you've done stuff like Are You Afraid of the Dark and stuff. What made you decide to go into screenwriting, or what are some of your favorite projects you worked on?
Well, Are You Afraid of the Dark is probably my favorite and everybody's favorite. That I did adapt a Charles Dickens short story, a little-known Charles Dickens short story called The Magic Fishbone, into a play for children. And I adapted another story called Wide Awake Jake and did some short writing for plays. But again, I just wasn't totally satisfied with the work, and I think I was looking for a way to do socially relevant work and also involve story.
Mm-hmm. And when and why did you decide to switch to making documentaries?
Well, it kind of happened by good luck, as many things in our lives do, that I had a friend who was a fellow parent. And we were both sort of looking around, you know, we were at one of those transitional points in our lives. And she said, I've just read this amazing story about this baseball team. And so I read the story and I thought it was amazing too. And she was much more experienced than I was, and she went and got the rights to the story. And then we started making a documentary, and then she got a wonderful job being head of video for Sesame Street. So she left the project and I got another partner, and then we were able to finish the film that way. The other partner was really great at fundraising, and so we were able to finish the film, and it was like somebody gave me a taste of chocolate for the first time, because I just loved it. I realized that I could tell stories, it was very visual, and that I could make a difference, that I could tell stories about social change.
Yeah, and you've done a lot of documentaries on a lot of different subjects. What do you look for in a documentary subject that makes you say, wow, I really want to tell this story?
Well, there are a couple of things. I really look for something, first of all, that I fall in love with, that I just have a real passion about. And then I look for something that's fundable, something that I'll be able to raise the money to do. And I also look for something that it's probably a story that's not out there. You know, we don't need the fifth film about, you know, a topic that's been really told over and over again, unless I have a really new point of view. And for me, it seems to be that my style is to get very involved with the individuals that I tell their stories, that I've gotten very close to the person who was in The Collector of Bedford Street. He lived across the street from me. And, you know, he was for a while my very best friend. And then I'm still very close to the surviving member of the Diana and Kathy, that Diana Braun still lives in Illinois. I just saw her last week. So I really engage with the people that allow me to tell their stories.
And Nina, there's been a lot about this recently. What is it like being a woman in the film industry, and how are you helping other women advance as well?
Gee, that's such a great question. I have a couple of ways of answering that. One is very personally. My daughter is a cinematographer, and I think it's less than 2% of the people in the Camera Guild are women. And so I feel like she's right on the edge, that she's fighting for her generation and for the women after her. And she already, she's been a cinematographer for about 10 years now. And she already sees that the women coming up behind her are having an easier time of it. And sometimes that makes her feel good, and sometimes it's a little frustrating. But for myself, I've been a member of New York Women in Film and Television. And news announcement. I'll see if I can turn off that part. But the women there are, it's a women's organization that, I'm sorry, I'm not sure. Are you still hearing me?
Yeah, I hear you.
Oh, good. Something happened on my computer, so I wasn't sure. I'm a member, as I said, of New York Women in Film and Television, and it's an organization that really is about enhancing women's roles in the film industry. And so I've been very fortunate. I've served on the board there. I was secretary, and I still serve on the scholarship committee because, again, I think the scholarship committee directly feeds into how many women can go to film school, how many women can feel support once they come out of film school. And I also take interns in my business, and I do take men also, but I also am very careful to always take women as well, because I want to be able to mentor them and give them an entry-level job into the film business.
And I mean, just to go over, what challenges are there for females in the film industry, just for people who aren't aware of what's exactly going on, and how is that sort of being addressed now?
I think that one of the big problems, and so it's being addressed, is it used to be the cameras were so heavy that a woman couldn't actually carry a camera, or shall I say, a woman without tremendous upper body strength couldn't carry a camera in the documentary world. So when I started making documentaries, I bought one of the very first digital cameras, and that was a big step forward. It was a small camera that would do broadcast quality work. So suddenly, women like myself could have access to the tools of visual storytelling. And so that's been a huge change in the business, that also the price of the camera came down. So that meant that not only could I tell stories, but people who traditionally couldn't have bought cameras would have access to cameras as well. So that's been a huge, huge change in the business.
Thank you. One of the ways, too, that you help is you're a professor at NYU. What is that like, being able to teach at a film school like that?
Well, I think the greatest thing, and I think every teacher here would say this, is our students, that they're so carefully vetted. They're the cream of the crop. Everybody wants to be here. Everybody's fighting to be here. So we get these amazing students who come into the class so ready to work, and something that's really changed is I announced to my students that they were going to have an editing component to their documentary class, and I had students say to me, well, I know how to edit. And I go, really? And they say, well, yes, I've been editing for 10 years. So this is an 18-year-old who's had an editing system since they were 8 years old. So they know a lot about computers, they know a lot about digital media, And what we try to do is just enhance that with some of the storytelling techniques, how you tell a story, not just that you can manipulate material and you can do it technically.
Mm-hmm. And what, now you've done some films about people with disabilities. What got you into doing films about people with disabilities? And did you work in disabilities studies before the film, or before the film started, or did you do, have you done that after, or any?
Well, you know, Jason, I've thought about that a lot because I keep being drawn back to these kinds of stories. And both my parents were in what I would call helping professions. My dad was a speech pathologist, and my mother was a nurse, and then she became a learning disabilities specialist. And so I grew up seeing people who did a lot of service, and we were taught how to talk on the phone, for example, to stutterers, because my father worked a lot with people who stuttered. And so as children, we were taught to, that there were all kinds of abilities in the world. And so I had a neighbor across the street from me, and I didn't know what his deal was, what was his story. And I began to find out from neighbors that even though he had an intellectual disability, every year he raised thousands of dollars for charity. And I began to think, wow, this isn't my idea of what somebody with a disability does. And so I began to learn from him. And I think about how different my life is because I knew him, that he taught me that philanthropists don't have to be rich. He taught me that people with disabilities, and intellectual disability in particular, have spiritual lives. That Larry believed in God. He'd been bar mitzvahed. And he had a very clear idea of right and wrong and how he wanted to spend his life. And it wasn't a way that you would necessarily say, oh, you should do this. But Larry had found a way to make his own path in life. And I think that that's really a sign of health and of typical behavior and all of those things that people might dismiss Larry as not having. Larry does and did. And so I learned so much from him that I became very interested in sort of multiple abilities, hidden abilities, all of the ways that we as individuals express our own particular talents.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I know you did, you've worked with Diane and Kathy, have you done any disabilities, you do a lot of consulting with disability media, how do you sort of have what sort of knowledge do you get from that? Is it firsthand experiences? Is it some professors at NYU? How do you sort of get the background to be able to consult in disability media management?
Well, I think a lot of it is from the connections I've made through my work, mm-hmm. that I see the films not just as films, but first, they have to be films. They have to be great stories because otherwise no one will watch them. I'm really not interested in what I call green vegetable films that are good for you, but they're not really much fun to watch. So I always want to tell a good story and have engaging characters and a progression during the film. And also I want to be honest. I want to say, people with disabilities are not perfect. We were just talking yesterday, what's, annoying is to have people with disabilities called angels, that they're not angels. They're real people with real problems and real solutions and real lives. And so I've learned a lot from the community itself, people sharing with me. I've recently done a lot of reading, actually, because I've become interested in the ADA and how we're going to be celebrating the ADA 25th anniversary this summer. So I decided to do a lot more background reading than I ever had before, and it's really inspired me, that just the journey that we're making and that we're in the process of making in this country, understanding that, for example, accessible buildings, accessible places aren't just for people with disabilities, they're for everyone. And, you know, that universal design is like a really important concept that we all need to embrace. Here at NYU, you know, we were just talking last night about how the tours for admissions, some of the tours aren't accessible. So how does that make somebody feel who might want to come to NYU and not be able to go on the tour, have to stand outside? So we need to do still education right here in my own backyard, so to speak, about the importance of accessibility, that we all are going to need accessibility sometime. And we all, you know, it's not a imposition or an expense that is taking away from anybody. It's actually giving to all of us so that we will have the ability to participate fully in our society and our community. That's my soapbox. I'm going to get up on it.
No, I think it was a really good point. And now you talked a little bit about this, but can you talk a little bit about the Larry and the Collector of Bedford Street, as well as Body and Soul, Diane and Kathy, a little bit about the films?
Sure. The Collector of Bedford Street, I look at, there's a Yiddish word called a mitzvah, which means it's a gift. Collector of Bedford Street was a total mitzvah for me. It was just a gift I thought I might want to make a film about Larry, and I got up in my block association meeting and I said, I think I'd like to make a film about Larry, but I don't have a camera. And one of my fellow community members raised her hand and she said, I have a camera. And I'd just been reading about saying yes to things. When people offer you things, say yes and see where it takes you. So I said yes, and that was the beginning of that film, that I used her camera for the first couple months of shooting before I could afford to buy my own camera. And then the whole story of that film was about saying yes and embracing the reality of Larry's life. And so I kept saying yes, and right down to when the head of documentary programming from HBO called me on a July 4th. I'll never forget it. I thought, why are we both doing work on July 4th? And she called me and she said, what do you want for your film? And I had really learned to ask for what I want instead of going, oh, you know, I just want it to be successful. I said, I want to win an Academy Award. And she said, then you have to come with HBO. And so I said yes, and so we went ahead, and every opportunity that I had, I said yes to, because I said I want to have no regret. I want to be able to know that I did everything I could to support this film and the story of this film, and it continues right up until the present day that I will, I'm working right now to see if we can get a screening of the film to celebrate the ADA's 25th anniversary in New York City, and so that film has had its own energy, shall I say. It just carried me along, and my job was to say yes to everything around that film. And then with Body and Soul, I should probably tell you briefly what the film's about. It's called The Collector of Bedford Street, and it's about my neighbor, Larry Selman, who is a man with intellectual disability. And every year, Larry raised thousands of dollars for charity. And so I documented that story, as well as the story of how Larry's uncle, who was his sole caretaker, was getting older. And Murray was actually losing his memory. And so we knew that someone would need to step up and take care of Larry. So our community came together, and we created a supplemental needs trust. And that was the first time that a community, rather than an individual's family, did that. And we did it with the support and help of the United States, the UJF, United Jewish Federation, and that they had a ability to create a trust fund for individuals, usually through their family, but because our community was Larry's family, they made an exception, and we were allowed to do that. And so Larry then, we were allowed to raise money and then put it into a fund for Larry's needs and supports. And the UGA also supplied us with an advocate for Larry, who would make sure that he was getting all the benefits that he was entitled to. And so that putting that in place took about 5 years, and the community came forward. And because Larry had created a lot of social capital, I don't know if you're familiar with that term, but it's someone who's been out in the community and has been doing a lot of work in the community, and people want to give back to him. And so we were able to raise, I believe it was $25,000 to start the fund, and then we kept putting in donations in order to maintain it and to maintain Larry all the way up through the time that he died in 2013. And so it was a really community effort. It was a effort from the UJA, and it was an effort from his advocate, which was provided by a group called FEGS. And so that was the story that I told in the film. And then the other film that you mentioned, Body and Soul, Diana and Kathy, is about a very unusual symbiotic relationship between a woman with Down syndrome and a woman with cerebral palsy. And they met in a sheltered workshop, and they came from very different backgrounds, but they were able to create an almost symbiotic relationship where Diana, who has Down syndrome, was able to become Kathy, who has cerebral palsy. She was able to become Kathy's support person. And Diana did that job for over 40 years. And they moved from a sheltered workshop, living in a group home, to living independently in an apartment, to being able to buy their own home and live independently in their own home. And part of this came about because Diana is able to drive, and she could put Kathy in the van. They had a van specially built for transportation. And they were very big advocates in the state of Illinois and nationally for disability rights. And Diana really facilitated Kathy's activism, that Kathy worked on a computer. She used a speaking device. But she was unable to really do any of the daily tasks of life for herself, which Diana did faithfully for over 40 years. Kathy died in 2009, and so Diana has been on her own, living in the same house that the two of them lived in. And I made another film 2 years ago, which was a self-advocates training video called Activate Here, and that's available for people free. It's downloadable. It's called Activate Here, and Diana was in that. And then I just went last week to Illinois to see Diana and to do some work with the Arc of Illinois. I received a media award from them. And while I was there, I shot a short film about how Diana is using technology. And she has recently received an iPad from the Arc of Illinois. They have a grant. She's now able to use that to receive her email, to take photos, and to do a lot of her advocacy work on the iPad. And she's been taking classes in it. And so I thought there was a kind of a new story here where Diana has sort of kept up with technology, and she loves her iPad. So anyway, the story of Body and Soul came about because Diana and Kathy asked me to make a documentary about them. And at first I said no, very foolishly, but then they invited me to their home, and they invited me to see how they lived, and I, of course, was totally impressed and thought there was a really good story there about how people had, Diana and Kathy had very creatively worked together to make a symbiotic relationship and to live independently and pursue their own interests.
Mm-hmm. Now, how come film, now I actually have a disability myself, I'm considered what's high-functioning autism, but I don't see many disability films that are that come around people with developmental or cognitive disabilities that tend to be less severe or tend to be able to less apparent. Why do you think that is? And do you think the film industry has a responsibility to show that aspect of disability life that maybe is not getting shown?
So let me just be sure I understand, Jason, that you think that there aren't many films that show people that, like maybe nonverbal or may not be as functioning on the same or on a level that is more typical. Is that correct?
That are actually pretty verbal. They live pretty normal lives. We have staff writers here who has cerebral palsy, who's going to the University of Cal. She's doing a lot of things. I know a lot of people from my back in schooling days who are doing a lot of things. I think sometimes the disability community tends to be more people that we can readily see as, oh, that person has a disability. But I think there's a lot of people out there who have disabilities who don't admit it because it's sort of frowned upon, but also they still have to deal with some of those things. And so how come, does the film industry have a sort of responsibility to show these less apparent disabilities to people, especially cognitive, intellectually, whether it's somebody with high functioning autism or whether it's somebody who has other things, learning disabilities or other sort of topics that don't always get touched upon?
Okay. Yeah, I agree. I think so. Yes, I think the film industry has a responsibility to show the full spectrum of human passion and human, experience. I think it's interesting too, and I think it's worthy, and I think it's attractive. People want to see how people of differing abilities solve problems, work through life. So there's a new film coming out called Jack of the Red Hearts, which is about someone with autism, and it's a narrative, or what we would call fiction film. But I just have seen two really good films about autism. One is called How to Dance in Ohio, and it's about a man who's running a program, and he decides to have a formal dance for the people in his program. And he knows that it will be stressful and it will create a lot of anxiety, but he also knows that the way people solve the problems will be very valuable. And so I really love this film. I saw it at the Full Frame Film Festival. It's a documentary. And it's just, it follows the people in the program as they prepare. They have to choose their outfits. They have to decide if they're going to invite someone to the dance. They have to decide if they're going to go single or stag to the dance. So it's a really, it shows a lot about the thought process. And I thought that was really worthwhile. And then the second film that I've seen recently that I really enjoyed was at the Tribeca Film Festival, and it's called Autism in Love, and it takes three different couples, or three different people, two of them are couples, and follows their stories. And so one is a couple that's been a couple for about, I think, 10 years, and during the course of the film, the man proposes to the woman, and they decide to get married. And they both have jobs. They're both, I guess you'd say they have Asperger's. And they are very much in love. And so during that time, they sort of culminate their long dating relationship into an engagement. The second is a couple that's been married for a long time, and she has breast cancer, and then she dies during the course of the film, and it's how he goes on after she has died. And then the third is a young man who has a lot of stress that he wants to date, and he ends up making some really bad choices, and then hopefully gets some guidance about how to make better choices about people to date. So those two films I would really look for, that they are just really excellent, and I, you know, highly recommend them. I'm sure they'll get some kind of wide release. I actually think one of them is going to be on HBO, and I'm not sure about the other, but they're things to look forward to.
Also, you're also doing a new film called The Miracle on 42nd Street, and we're all here about innovative ideas about disability or poverty or mental health or women's rights and so forth. Can you tell us about the innovation that goes on in that film about housing?
Yes, I would love to, actually. The film is about affordable housing for artists, and so it really highlights the role that artists play in our communities in terms of being an economic stabilizer and an economic generator. And the idea is that there are artists living in all communities, and if they're given a little bit of support, they can often make a big contribution back to the community where they live.
Mm. Oh, keep going, sorry.
Oh, that's all right. No, and so we follow, the main part of the story is the Manhattan Plaza, which has been a 35-year experiment in affordable housing for artists. It's subsidized housing for artists, and it has three different levels of subsidy. They have Section 8, which is people really living almost at the poverty line, and they have middle income subsidy, which is called Mitchell Llama, which is a New York State program, and then they have what they call fair market. So this building is quite innovative, Manhattan Plaza in New York City. It's between 9th and 10th Avenues, because it is one of the first buildings to truly have mixed income, that people pay a portion of their income. So if you are a performing artist and you have a really, really good year and you make a lot of money, you pay more rent. And then if your income declines because you don't get in that Broadway show or you're not performing at Lincoln Center that year, then your rent goes down. So it's on a sliding scale. And it includes the building itself is very innovative. It has a cogeneration plant, which means they supply their own heat and hot water and air conditioning in the summer, that they are what's known as a NOR, which is a naturally occurring retirement community, that once people move into that building, they rarely move out, and so they're setting up services in the building so people can maintain their own apartments. And the manager told me they probably only had two, maybe three people have to transfer to nursing homes or other facilities from Manhattan Plaza. It's a fully accessible building that you can be on a scooter or a walker and have full accessibility to all of the facilities in the building. There's a health club in the building. There's a swimming pool for residents. There's a child care nursery school. They've set up many tenant-run organizations like Broadway theaters, if they need audiences, often donate tickets, and so there are tickets available on a daily basis in the building. That there are just many, that one of the big things actually was in the New York Times today is how important transportation is for low-income people to be able to get to cheaper stores, to be able to get to work. And so Manhattan Plaza has been innovative since it was built because it's a block from the Port Authority, which is one of our big transportation hubs in New York City, as well as being a block from major subway lines. And it's walkable for people performing on Broadway because it's just a few blocks from the Broadway theaters. So it's a very innovative housing, which people have studied. And then they've begun to create affordable housing. There are places like an organization called Art Space, which is based out of Minneapolis, that has helped cities and communities create affordable housing from artists on a scale that's appropriate to that community. So, for example, in Minot, North Dakota, there, I believe, are 5 or 10 units for artists there. And some of those artists are Native artists. And then you'll have also people that are you'll have places like Providence, Rhode Island. You'll have places like Rahway, New Jersey, which is working with the Actors Fund to create affordable housing for artists. And Rahway is 30 minutes from Midtown Manhattan, so it's a great place for artists, as well as having three or four theaters in Rahway itself. And there are places like Ajo, Arizona, that have converted an old Lick school there into affordable housing for artists, which has a free print shop. It has, it's going to have a conference center. And so there are many creative ways of creating affordable housing in different communities.
Now, when is, do you have a release date for when that film is? So, I mean, it sounds really interesting.
So what I would say to you, Jason, is cross your fingers, because we were very lucky. We received the National Endowment for the Arts grant, and now we're matching that grant, and we're moving along doing it. We have some really great supporters. We have wonderful places that are interested in seeing this story happen, and so we're really working hard, because every grant that's given to us right now is matched by our National Endowment money. So it's your tax dollars at work.